Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 20th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we are talking about partisan politics, and the panel is Michael Miller, Charles Hayes, and Judy Donegan. Now, Charles and Judy have been here. Michael, you're familiar with the room because you've been here many times, but never sitting with the Bridging the Gap crowd.
That is here, yes.
Yeah, okay. Partisan politics today. Trump got a lot of votes from people who just hate the Democrats. What is it about the Democrats that generates so much hate? Is it just Hillary or Nancy, or is there something more? What causes the hate, Charles?
Well, I've been studying this subject for an awful long time, and recently I've changed the whole way I look at it, totally. I've come at it from the biological perspective. I grew up thinking that, being taught that our brains are similar to computers, but it turns out that our brains are more like a gland. We have a chemical factory in our heads, and we are literally chemically cocktailed for tribalism.
Okay, what about the hate, though?
Well, that's coming.
Okay.
The oxytocin, vasopressin, and serotonin are hormones that have a lot to do with how we relate to one another. These processes take place in milliseconds before the thought of what's going on occurs to us. So we automatically do this. Oxytocin has always been called the love hormone. It's how we bond with children, how we get along with people. But oxytocin, when push comes to shove, it turns us against people we consider others. We've only known that for about 10, 15 years. So, consequently, with a movement going on in Brexit, where liberal countries, when the first started the diaspora from the war, started getting a lot of immigrants, at first everything was okay. But at a certain point, even the liberals get too much otherness. We're chemically cocktailed against it. So
chemically cocktailed to hate?
If it comes to the point, yes. We can only stand so much otherness, it seems. Or at least some people are more prone to it than others. I mean, obviously.
Okay, anything beyond the chemicals that's causing this hate between the Democrats and the people who hate the Democrats? Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I was going to say, to some degree, those are two separate questions to me. I mean, I definitely agree with Robert that we have...
Charles, by the way.
I'm sorry, Charles. I'm really good at this, as you can tell. I need something tattooed on my head.
Well, you just met everybody a few minutes ago.
You should see what happens when I go home and forget everybody's name there. We all have an off switch for the other. Absolutely, right? We have an on-off switch. I don't think anyone's exempt for that. And the minute we flip that switch for someone who's other or something that is other, we therefore stop seeing them as human. We can treat them in all sorts of terrible ways. But I guess I disagree with the premise of the question that anyone voted for Trump, not that some, obviously many people didn't, but that the primary reason people voted for Trump is because they hate Democrats.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there was a lot of people who voted for Trump that did hate the Democrats.
I mean, no question. I would say that when you have partisan politics, by its very nature, you dislike the people who are on the opposite side from you, right? But I think that in terms of bridging the gap in this conversation, one of the most interesting things over the past year has been after the initial horror that the country elected who they did, at least for me, having in-depth conversations with people who did vote for Trump and continue to support him now when I think many people are just, again, aghast about that. And by and large, I haven't talked to one person so far who voted for them, for Trump, either A, because they hated Democrats or even felt very strongly about that. I mean, sure, they do. They post memes about it. But they largely had other really strong motivating factors. And some of it was about the other, absolutely, whether it's illegal immigration or something similar. But a lot of it was out of probably what's a different human desire, which is to feel that you're so trapped in a situation that you're willing to do anything to get out of that situation. You're willing to blow it up to any degree. And I've talked to plenty of people who that they just wanted to change. They just wanted a shakeup. They just wanted to change what the situation was. They didn't care what the cost was. They didn't think the cost would be too high, almost no matter what the cost would be. They wanted to blow up the status quo.
No hate for the Democrats, Judy?
Well, I don't know if I would phrase it that way. That surprised me a little bit. But I think that what Michael was just saying, if I can remember, is that they wanted to, Trump voters or Republican voters wanted to blow up the status quo. I think if you step back from that, I think that there's a feeling that was enhanced by the campaign that there is a loss among many Trump voters or Republican voters, a loss of their status as men, usually, of white privilege. Mm-hmm. And so I think it goes back to Lyndon Johnson once said that something about if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the other, then they'll feel good about you. So I think it's tribalism, but I think it's it predates this campaign. It's sort of a slow erosion of the privilege that white men have experienced.
Okay, we're well into the primary season. Not in Alaska yet. I think that's August 25th or something like that. But into the primary season, and it looks like there are going to be a lot of women on the ballot this November, all across the country. Any significance to this development, and does it relate to partisanship, the fact that women are now?
It's probably going to create a worse backlash, ultimately. I mean, the more women that get into power, I suppose, the more white males lose their privilege.
So back to what you were saying about the white male being threatened, mm-hmm. The fact that women are into it now are going to threaten them even more.
Well, perhaps. I think that women's rise to power, a black president, all those things contribute to this feeling of disenfranchisement that a lot of probably Trump voters have felt. I mean, I think we're describing this the same thing from different angles, really.
I'm for turning it all over to women. Really? I'm serious.
Can they do any worse than what we've done?
No.
Old white men.
I guess the question for me would be, regardless of who's running, do we see a path forward in the country for actually not having it be a seesaw where one group wins and takes control and then the other group wins and takes control, and we are increasingly leading ourselves to voting for the most radical change we can in whatever particular area of belief that we have? Because the real question for me isn't, do we reelect Trump? Although that's certainly a question. The real question for me is, what happens after Trump? Do we just go back to the status quo? Frankly, that seems unlikely. So, yeah, we're getting more and more diversity in terms of who's running for office, thank goodness, and that is awesome. But what are we... I think that we have a tendency to look for people, to the people who are running for office for our answers and the people who are in office for our answers, when it so clearly starts with the people who are voting in the first place. So my question is, for myself, what am I voting for, and how do I have to be voting any different, or what activities do I have? What activism should I be part of to change what is clearly happening in the country, which is to get more and more divisive rather than less?
Okay, I just received a note from our crack research staff here, and he asked about the two parties and the women that are involved in each of the parties. Can we speak to that a little bit?
I thought it was more Democratic women than Republican women. You know, I don't want to change the subject, Paul. I think this is related. I just read the Supreme Court has just been doing gerrymandering cases, mm-hmm. and the Wisconsin case is Gill versus Whitford, and I won't go into this except to say Bill Whitford was my law professor and a very good friend of mine. But the Supreme Court dismissed the case for lack of standing. But they kept the case alive, which was a little bit remarkable.
So they sent it back to the state
Sent it back
Supreme
to the
Court?
District Court
okay.
For an evaluation of whether there were plaintiffs that could establish standing. I don't want to get in the weeds. But Kagan, in her concurrence with that decision, pointed out that what gerrymandering has done is create districts that are largely one party or another. Mm-hmm. And so that the Republicans are packed into a district.
In Wisconsin, where in Maryland it's the Democrats that are doing it.
In Wisconsin, it's Republicans. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Maryland, it's Democrats. Right. But what she says is that what that does is it creates this extremism. Because if you know you're going to win your district, then your danger is the primary. And your danger in the primary is from your right base. Flank.
Yeah.
And so until it seems to me back to what Michael said, how do we get out of this? How do we arrive at some place where we can compromise and actually do some sensible things? And in fact, how do we get out of gerrymandering? I mean, the Supreme Court just dismissed a Texas case yesterday or today.
It's interesting because Texas, if I remember correctly, actually has several districts that used to vote Democratic and used to elect Democratic representatives. And after they were redistricted, then they started to go entirely red all the time. And you're absolutely right, Paul. I mean, both parties have been guilty of doing this and justifying it by the fact that the other party does it. How do we break that? I mean, I think we have a number of things in the system that we are okay with whenever we're on top. Whichever one of us is on, whoever is on top, if you're part of that group, then we're okay with it as long as it serves our goals and ideals.
Which is power.
Which is, yeah, sometimes I think for some people it's just, hey, I really want to do X, Y, Z for my country because it's going to be good for it, I believe, and I got to this point in this way, it works for me, that's great. But it seems that the conversation needs to be, like what Judy is saying, a much more basic reevaluation of some of our systems that has led us to increasingly have a two-party system and more in that, like an extremist two-party system.
Charles, what about the propensity of Democrats to have more women than the Republicans as candidates?
Propensity to have more?
Well, are we agreed that that's the case?
I think it's the case. Okay. I hope it's the case.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm so upset and aggravated about the whole situation. I don't see any way to get a real consensus out of this without a serious common enemy or a catastrophe. Mm. One of those two things is going to have to happen before we come together, so to speak.
Well, that question is going to be later on in the show. Okay, the catastrophic aspect of it. There has been a lot of talk on the airways and cable channels that the Republican Party is now the party of Trump. A poll came out today that said 90% of registered Republicans approve of Trump's presidency.
More than any, I think his favorability amongst his base is higher than it was even with Reagan, or as high.
Those numbers scare the out of me. But when you look at the numbers, there also is, I just saw polls that like 24% of the population identifies as Republican. So if you take 90% of 24%, you get 21%.
We need to look at those numbers, yes, as far as the total population.
Before we just go nuts
about it. That's a good point, yeah.
I mean, it's still appalling.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Reno Free Palmer Big Cabbage Radio. Today we are discussing partisan politics with Michael Miller, Charles Hayes, and Judy Donegan. As far as the Republicans being Trump's party, what is that as far as the ramifications for our future as a Democratic Republic? Anybody scared by that fact?
I'm horrified by it. I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, there's something confusing about when we talk about identity politics. When conservatives talk about identity politics, what they're talking about is when we talk about minority rights or LGBT or civil rights or those kind of things.
Special interests.
Right. But they are the biggest identity of identity politics just in us and them. They see us as the other, and liberalism is as otherness as you can get to them. That's where your hate comes in from people that hate Democrats, because they on a whole nother deep psychological level, the existential level, as cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker talked about in the Denial of Death, is that change, otherness, and those kind of things are connected to mortality salience. And we human beings are time-stamped, that we don't have but so much time. If we were immortal, these problems wouldn't bother us, because you wouldn't think that this group over here is keeping you from becoming rich, because you can get rich in 2-3 centuries later if you need to.
So immortality is going to solve all these issues. I think I get what you're talking about. So what do you think about that, the future of our republic as far as the Republicans being so totally bound to Trump? Is there any danger in that, Michael?
Well, I think that the real question is it possible to have a Democratic Trump? And I guess what I'm saying by that, obviously, wouldn't be the same politics, right? But again, if we assume this isn't a weird anomaly, if this is a manifestation of a symptom in the American system, then sure, we can be horrified all we want that 24% or 21% of the American public are 100% behind Trump. But that isn't necessarily us bridging the gap, because we're essentially writing off 21% of the population, which is clearly part of a trend. And
we're not writing them off. We just haven't figured out a way to get...
Right, but we're not, like, we don't even understand their motivation. We're just, like, horrified. We're just going, oh, my gosh, what is even happening? We don't understand. And I am not sure that is one thing, and I could say, and I've definitely said this, we should talk to people, we should understand people, all of this. But there is a flip side to that, which I'm sure there's a 21% of the American population on the other side that is currently active and enraged and horrified. But who will they necessarily elect? And... Or who will they help? Who will they propel along with the help of moderates in the middle, who tend to go with whatever the next swing will be? Who will be in power next? And so we have a figure in power right now that's trying to act with as many executive orders as possible. Right? They're trying to enact and work outside of the legislative branch to the degree that they can. And my fear is not, again, what is happening right now, although that is plenty terrifying to me on plenty of other levels. My fear is that we take the swing too far in different directions each time. Because if you look at the pendulum of politics over the past 10 years, that's what's been happening. We elect one president, then in the midterms we have a mad rush to the other side. Then we elect another president, we have a mad rush to the other side. And
Obama Obama was the swing? Way to the other side?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really? Well, from the perspective of conservatives, not from the perspective of progressives and liberals, absolutely.
Was it because
not,
of his policies or because of his race?
That he was
both.
Elected?
You think his policies were...
I think that he was a very unifying figure, like in general, on any number of levels. I mean, that's a kind of a separate topic. But I do know that conservatives, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen the meme from The Onion and when the year he got elected, it said white hot ball of Republican rage gets elected in 2017. And that came true. The Onion article was just a prophecy. Yeah.
How do you bridge the gap in a situation like President Obama would give one of his speeches or something, I would listen to it thinking, my God, what an incredible human being. And then listen to the other side saying, we just heard a man that hates America. Right. I mean, you know, how do you talk to people like that? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I wouldn't talk to those pundits personally, and I think that's one of the reasons that motivated me to start this show, is because that's the way they act, and that's the way perspective.
I don't know. I think right now the pundits are acting way too timid, in a way. You're talking about pundits on, say, Fox News or Breitbart or somewhere there, and yes. And he's a Muslim and all that awful stuff. But right now, I listen to the National Network News and to the PBS NewsHour. And partly I think I do it. Some people say, why do you bother with that? You know, it's not news. I think I do it to see what is going out there to a large portion of the public, to see what they're hearing. And there's still a tendency, and Michael, I think you were just doing it, sort of a tendency to say, well, yes, Trump is doing this, but, you know, the Democrats had cheese for dinner or something. I mean, there is a tendency to try to, fairness can be carried too far.
I think.
I don't think it becomes fair at that point.
Obama was pretty much the epitome of moderation. Mm-hmm. I don't believe. I mean, they talked about him as being the deporter in chief, and that's because what he did better than a lot of presidents was he administered well. He was a good administrator
against incredible obstruction, obstruction, unprecedented obstruction.
Never mind.
Why has the truth become less important than party loyalty? And it has. We can't deny that it has. Why has it become? Well, what is it about us that was willing to accept party loyalty beyond the truth?
If the president is a proven pathological liar, what could possibly happen besides that? I mean, he's been it's become normalized. I mean, his press secretary stands up and bump stocks lies, you know, right and left, and the it happens every day, and it's become normal. I mean,
well, his tweets have multiple lies in every one of them.
I know.
Why? This is a question. Why is party loyalty more important than the truth?
Well,
back to the other? Are we back to the chemical thing?
In a way, that's real important. In human evolution, when people used to die from eating the wrong stuff or, you know, bad stuff, the insular cortex is where we register disgust. Well, we human beings are so good with this disgust that we have learned to do it metaphorically. We can put this other group, but be disgusted, literally, metaphorically, by another group, and we put them in the same place that something that makes us throw up. When you get that, when you get somebody in there, you can't talk them out of it. You're just disgusted, and that's we have become polarized to the point to where both sides are disgusted by the other side.
So whatever comes out that manages to disgust us the most, we accept that as more important than the truth.
It blinds us to the it stops us. I mean, it stops the discussion. I mean, these people are disgusting. I mean, you can't. Believe what they say. You can't rationalize with them. You can't talk to them. I mean, we don't hear each other.
Michael, any explanation for why party loyalty is more important than the truth?
I think that works as well. I think that's an awesome rabbit hole unto itself. But I would also add that it has become so much easier to have access to seemingly legitimate news that is an absolute falsehood than it ever has been before. And we have successfully taken one of the greatest creations of humanity of all time, which is the internet, and used its ability to disseminate free information from all sources with equal value. And instead, what we've done is created little information silos where we eagerly repeat to ourselves what we want to hear. And I see extraordinarily intelligent people routinely promote things online, whether it's on social media or by email or however you want to say it, complete falsehoods that are, it's 2 seconds to check. And you know, I mean, we're talking people with PhDs, we're talking people who are lawyers and bankers, we're talking to just like repost stuff that's just a lie. And for someone who loves the internet as much as I do, that's probably the most disheartening thing I see, where you've taken this tool and you've just turned it into a lie factory. And so I don't know if necessarily party loyalty has changed. I mean, I believe it probably has. But even if you just throw in our overall access to falsehood has gone up by 300%.
That was a telepathic segue into this next question, which is, what role does social media play in this partisan divide? I think we heard from Michael about the role it plays. Is there anything you want to add to that, Judy?
Well, I guess I agree with Michael. So probably not. But it seems to me that the acceptance of lies and of misinformation exists in the face of actual video of somebody's, of what Trump is saying, or an actual, one thing you're saying about checking what you share on social media, I saw some of Melania's coat. Can we go to fashion? So
that's the last question, but we can go ahead and talk about that now.
Sorry about that.
No.
So I saw people with a picture of that, and then the question is this real? I mean, you can hardly believe that something like that actually happened. Would someone wear that coat? A model. It's not an accident. So at the same time, you can have Trump saying something, and you can have Sarah Huckabee saying he didn't say it, or Kellyanne Conway saying he didn't say it, and somehow in the face of the video, people will say, well, no, that's wrong.
I think it's really important to point out that communications technology and social media is what's driving this thing in the first place.
So the role of social media is prominent,
well,
do you believe?
Well, the world is being re-tribalized. And if you go back and think about anthropology, primitive tribes were a whole lot better at tribalism than we are. They had all their needs met in a little small group, and they could go right up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and it was all self-contained. But there's a big difference in them. They didn't have the whole world broadcasting information daily that showed that their views weren't very popular. We're constantly under it. No matter what you think, no matter what you believe, you're going to be bombarded with information to the contrary unless you choose to do a narrow band and live in an echo chamber.
Okay. Now, is there any fix to the rules to social media that may help matters? Or is it already too far water under the bridge, too far gone?
If you could get to the point to where any party that wants to discuss anything cared more about a solution than they did about whose side won, that's the criteria in which to engage.
Okay, so you're now king of the world, and you're in charge of social media. Okay. What would you say? What could we do? What could you implement that could fix this?
I don't personally. I'm sorry if I'm
you're king now because you took too long. So.
You know, as much as I was just sitting here and saying that the amount of falsehood we have has gone up so drastically, I think that part of what we're seeing is just the fact that humanity has always come up with technology before, or they've come up with concepts before we're ready to grasp with them really, truly, fully. And so I don't think there is a fix. I don't think there is a make sure Twitter enforces its policies better or have longer tweets or any of that is really going to make a difference outside of us as society. Maybe this is going to like happen after America implodes and eats itself alive, or maybe it's 200 years or 10 years or who knows. But we have to readjust to what is a colossal shift in how we share information with one another. It's unprecedented, right? I mean, truly, what the internet is doing to human culture, we have absolutely no precedent for. And it's worth noting that my favorite drum to beat on this is exactly what started off, it is shifts like that started off the persecution of witches in the medieval ages when they invented the printing press, which is an awesome invention, right? We love books. Books are so lovely, and we talk about reading them instead of being on the internet. But early on, they were used to spread disinformation and lies and
heresy.
Start witch hunts. So, and then eventually society had to adjust and go, okay, not everything printed in books is true, I guess. Wow. And I don't know that we have a choice but to strap in for the ride.
So, Judy, you're in charge of the world now. What would you do to fix this?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not exactly an internet guru. But I think that part of our problem is the education system. And that we have to start, I mean, it's what Michael said. We're not ready for the internet and this kind of thing because we, maybe even people my age, but I think younger people, a lot of people have not been sufficiently educated on looking at something and examining whether that's true or whether that could possibly be true or whether there's someone has an ulterior motive in what they're doing. The study of when I was younger, I thought I wanted to go into advertising. It's like horrifies me now. What was wrong? I also wanted to be a U.S. senator. So, but it's that we don't have a sufficient education on how to deal with propaganda
holistically.
We are better at educating human doings than human beings. Mm-hmm. I mean, education is the only patch that they'll cure this in my book. And you have to, I mean, people need what I call, used to call a liberal education. I call it existential education. So you can handle your own angst without finding somebody to blame.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF Radio Free Palmer. Today we're talking about partisan politics with Judy Donegan, Charles Hayes, and Michael Miller. Is ripping children from their parents at the U.S. border a partisan political issue?
Not unless you make it one.
Has it become one?
Well, I think so.
I would definitely say that if you want to look at it in terms of where you'll fall in history, this goes right up there with Japanese internment camps. Like, you can justify it any way you want, and you can talk party politics all you want, but it's ultimately someone is dehumanizing somebody else to the point where they just don't care what happens to those children, and they are applying to them the actions of adults and holding them culpable and responsible for actions and choices they have no control over. And no, I mean, that definitely falls for me under the, that's a line I will die on very happily. If someone wants to talk to me about this being a partisan politics issue, and sure, it's currently Republicans who are supporting it, but it's a humanity issue. It's just this is not acceptable issue. And I think the outcry has generally backed that up. It just got to a point where any human being who cares about a child and has ever looked a child in the eye cannot accept that. And it seems, thankfully, we didn't. And yeah, the Republican Party, you know, huge swaths of it were willing to support that. And that is terrible. I've not yet successfully had a conversation with anyone who told me, well, their parents chose to come here, and
break the law by crossing the border.
Yeah, so therefore, whatever, you put the kids in a garbage compactor, we don't care. I mean, that is the vibe that I get. I have not had a conversation with someone, so I can't speak to it, but I guess that's something that I would say, you know, speaking of what Judy said about fairness, that's a classic example of an issue. I don't care what party you're part of. I don't care what your rationalization is. You've crossed the line. And we don't need to be having a conversation about it. It just needs to stop.
Well, Trump does those kind of things for the sake of outrage. I mean, he does it because we our heads explode.
Well, there's been reports from the White House that he thinks he's on the right side of this issue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and he thinks this is a winning issue, and mm-hmm. It might be among his base.
We're back to the 21% then, right?
Well, yeah. Well, his base is probably bigger than 21%, but it's 21% of Republicans. There are other people, apparently, who are in his base, which is truly scary. But I'm losing my train of thought. I got lost.
There have been a number of congressional delegations that have gone to these internment camps, or I should call them detention facilities if I'm going to be politically correct, but they're all Democrats. Why no Republicans have shown up?
Oh, Melania did.
Oh, that's true. Yes, yes. But is she really? Is she a U.S. citizen?
Yeah.
She is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that almost seems to me like a question of why has the Republican Party been silent on Trump, which is absolutely mystifying and not mystifying in other ways. And I guess, you know, to go in a roundabout way to what you're asking, yeah, it's clearly become a partisan issue on the national stage. And I guess my response is it shouldn't be for us personally. And I don't care who is or is not supporting it. I want it to stop. And I don't, you know, it's irrelevant to me to a certain degree of whether or not I see someone who's going to win, who's a Democrat, Republican, if they're for this, I'm against them sort of thing, as long as it's going on.
That's your litmus test then?
I mean, we're all one-issue voters on something, and for me it's definitely if you take it to the point where you're willing to just grossly, flagrantly ignore humanity, yeah, absolutely. Then, and I think maybe that's for me, and maybe someone can correct me and say how wrong I am, but that for me is where I feel bipartisan is if I feel someone is supporting conservative policies and is strongly conservative, but they are not throwing children into camps, then that's fine. I can have a conversation with them. But if you're going to come to me and if you're a liberal, which I have not talked to any right now, absolutely, who support this, then I'm sorry. I'm not really interested in who you are and what you're supporting. You've crossed a line in the sand that has nothing to do with politics and everything to do with humanity. And, yeah, we all have things that we would argue cross that line, but this one's pretty clear.
Big question right now that Maxine Waters telling Sanders she has to leave the restaurant. I mean, asked her to leave and all kinds of stuff. So what do you think about that? I have incredibly mixed feelings about that. I mean, I'm all for civility. I'm all for it. But at what point? At what point do you start calling people out if they rip the government apart? If they tear up the Constitution? If they start locking people up because you're opposed to them? Do you speak up then?
We have to be resistant if we're going to be civil, but we still have to maintain our resistance.
I go back and look at the history of the 1930s and all the different things that happened, and people kept quiet, and people were civil, they were nice. But how far does that have to go? I'm not sure. And for the last 20 years or longer, on the right wing, in right wing media, there has been this legendary tale of Jane Fonda going to a steak restaurant in Montana and getting kicked out. It's not true, but they revel in it. They revel in the fact that they did that. I mean, what happened was she went there and there was too big of a line and she left. But anyway, I mean.
Well, so. I think the thing that came out of that in my mind as it occurred, first it was the Secretary of Homeland Security, and then it was the Mexican restaurant, Stephen Miller. But whenever the baker refused to bake the cake for the gay people, that wasn't discrimination.
How is that different?
That was a whole category of people.
Yeah.
And we're only talking about individuals now. Right. I don't know.
I don't either. And it's hard to know how hard the Democrats fight back, how hard we fight back on this, and what are the political ramifications of doing that, and, you know, who should the Democrats nominate? I don't know, because I think I have a tendency to want civility, to want us to be better than them and not to stoop to those levels. But can you do that in this climate?
We have a reputation for bringing knives to gunfights, you know?
I would definitely argue that everyone who's been on the right side of history in the past has successfully done that. And
Done
it civilly.
And I think that this really needs to be clarified because there is a lot of conversation happening right now about how...
Really? Really?
Yeah.
The Jewish people and the Nazis...
Well, so there's
they won.
The Americans and the Russians won that war, Charles.
Oh, I know, but
a lot of Jews died.
But that's not to say that being civil gets you to win. By no means. Just as necessarily being a pacifist doesn't make you win. And I'm not saying we all have to
talking about
pacifists.
The right side of history.
I'm talking about people who are on the right side of history, and I'm talking people who enacted great change, and in that, I think there has been a conflation between civility and compliance, and those are not the same thing at all. There has been a lot of conversation about the call out that Martin Luther King did of Dr. Martin Luther King of white moderates.
Civil disobedience.
Right. So your opinions can be radical. Your actions can be radical because you are bucking the law and you're bucking the trend. But how you treat other human beings does not have to treat them as animals. You don't have to treat them with hatred, right? You as a human being, how you treat others has nothing to do with you standing up for what you believe in.
Has there been any conservative more civil than George Will just in his presentation?
Yeah.
And look what he just came out with.
Yeah.
He wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post that said that we need to vote against the GOP. And he's been a staunch Republican all this time.
Of course, that's not incivil to do that. I mean, you know, to say...
Well, he was very civil in the way he presented his argument.
In doing it. So, but to think about Kirstjen Nielsen,
right.
Is that deliberate? Do you actually separate families at the Mexican border and then go to a Mexican restaurant? I mean, is that giving the finger to...
Well, what, Steve Miller, too. I mean,
he's beyond the pale. But, you know, I mean, does she deserve... did she start it? Was that deliberate, or are they that tone deaf?
Tone deaf, I think. I think it's tone deaf.
I would definitely agree that from the perspective of many people, they do not see what they're supporting or what they're doing as either being racist or even as being predisposed against Hispanic culture. And they would say that that restaurant is there because they immigrated legally and they therefore support them. And that has nothing to do with being here illegally. That's really the rallying cry. I'll tell you what, I'm fine with that argument. What I'm not fine with is saying if you're here illegally, we get to take your 4-year-old away from you. Like, that goes back to that. There's a certain line of arguments, I'll take anything you want to say, but that your politics shouldn't be impacting 4-year-old children.
One anthropological phenomenon that I observed, and you all can correct me if you don't see it that way, but I observed that since I started doing this show, there was a difference in attitude about Trump by partisan Democrats and citizens like myself who are not affiliated with either party. It is obvious to me that Trump's behavior is one of a criminal trying to avoid prosecution. It shows up in his tweets, his speeches, his lies, his pardons, Putin, everywhere. The Democrats that I have encountered are not willing to admit that it is even possible that Trump could be a criminal.
Oh, my God.
While non-affiliates see it clearly. Can you explain why?
They don't. Democrats you've encountered?
I have the partisan Democrats that I have encountered. I asked the question on a show. The question was this: is it possible that Trump's behavior is due to the fact that he is actually guilty and trying to avoid prosecution?
Absolutely, in my book.
Okay. Well, you weren't here. You weren't on the panel that day.
I would agree with Charles.
Now, let me ask you this thing. Do you two consider yourselves as partisan Democrats?
I happen to be registered, nonpartisan or something here, because I was shocked when I went to DMV and they were going to have me register and I had to declare things. But I was just sort of not thinking. But my entire life, I have been a Democrat. My family, I'm from Minnesota. We are DFL. That's Democratic Farmer Labor People. So that's to the left of the Democratic Party, although Minnesota's going bad too. So, I consider myself a Democrat, even though that's not how I'm registered.
Okay.
I grew up a hard, hard right Republican into my mid-30s. Now I'm a flaming liberal, but I will put out the flame and just use it as a pilot light if I can find somebody to negotiate with.
Well, and don't you think, Charles, you and I are old enough to know, back in the day when there were Republicans, like Rockefeller Republicans, or I have worked not directly with, but in the same court, with people nominated by Republican presidents, people that I often disagree with, who are very much more want to throw criminals away and that sort of thing, but that are decent people that you can actually talk to, and that
this former cop sitting next to you.
I call them Jurassic conservatives. If you go back and look at the 1956 political agenda on the GOP, it sounds left of us right now. I mean, mm-hmm. on the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it just seems so different now, because I tried to analyze earlier in the Trump administration so that I wasn't being exactly tribal. I tried to
try to look at the truth, maybe.
I tried to look at, you know, am I disagreeing with this man because I don't want tax cuts for the rich? Or I want environmental regulation. That would be one of my main things. Do I find him so repulsive because of the way he acts, rather than, I mean, if he were not acting like that and he had what I consider to be a lot of bad policies, I think I could deal with that. I think we expect that. But there's something so toxic about what's going on.
He is subversively making bigotry and racism a part of public policy.
And so, yes, and it's diversion, perhaps, from the fact that, yes, I think he is avoiding the fact that he could be criminally prosecuted.
What do you think about that, Michael?
Well, you don't say that you have the power to pardon yourself, but by the way, it doesn't matter. Unless it matters.
I mean, that's kind of a good point, actually.
I'm afraid that what's going to happen is Mueller's going to lay all this stuff out. I mean, it's going to be a horrific case. It's going to be criminal on money laundering and every way you can think of it. And he's going to give it to the Congress. And then what happens?
Well, I think that on earlier shows, the solution to that was show up in November, this November, and that way you won't have a Republican-controlled House. Of course, you still have – you'll still need 67 votes out of the Senate, which seems unlikely. But a lot of Republicans were about to vote to impeach Nixon back in 1974.
Mm, that was a different time.
Yeah, very, very different time.
Wasn't there a Democratic Congress?
I think it's important to point out that things are more partisan now, and they're more divisive now than they have in any time in my lifetime, and I'm 75 years old. But they're not more divisive than they have been in the country in the past.
Right.
I mean, the 1860s was a whole lot more divisive than that.
Really bad, really bad. Lots of people, lots of casualties from that time. Let's talk a little bit about the history of what I see as the beginning of the polarization that actually occurred. And I'm going back to Clinton's impeachment. My recollection was that Clinton was barely able – or they were barely able to get Clinton to do the deposition about Paula Jones because there was only a week or so before the statute of limitations was running out on Paula Jones before Ken Starr or whoever took on that suit. And through that deposition, they managed to ask him about Monica Lewinsky, what Monica Lewinsky has to do with Paula Jones. And that's where they caught him in the lie. And I recall at that time that Newt Gingrich, who had just dumped his wife when she was dying of cancer in the hospital, was not really a good enough speaker for that issue, that they had to get rid of him, and they ended up trying one guy who was also having an affair that people found out about it, so they couldn't use him, a guy from California, I can't remember his name. And then they ended up with the guy who was the wrestling coach, who was as speaker. I don't know his name.
Yeah.
He's the big
Danny Haskett.
Haskett. Yes.
Oh yeah. Well,
yeah,
he had problems. Yes.
He had problems too, but that came way later. But he was squeaky clean at the time. But I remember how that vote went, and it was just all about, you know, we have to get Clinton here, and it didn't matter anything about what really happened because they were all having sex. They all had mistresses, but they were willing to just go all in on getting Clinton impeached on this very technical thing, which came out of a deposition, out of a civil suit.
Well, I'm thankful
that's
for
where
that
it started.
Now.
That's where it started in my mind. You guys have anything else that historically that you could add to that?
I don't think I have anything useful to add outside of being really aware, having grown up in a very conservative area, how much conservatives hated Clinton. And to listen to the narrative back then, speaking of what we were talking about earlier about the end of the world being around the corner, you would think, or I even heard that he was inviting UN troops to secretly park in national parks just so they could rush out and invade the United States.
The black helicopters.
Yeah, Agenda 21, the whole shebang. Maybe it started before that, but partisan politics was well on its way at that point.
But it really emerged with the vote to impeach. He was actually impeached by the House. And because they couldn't get enough votes in the Senate, that was the end of it. But his popularity, the polls at that, right after that, were sky high. Clinton's polls, poll numbers.
Well, and that's a fear on our side, that if we impeach him and run him off, that maybe it comes back on us in 2020. You know, and that's as weird as this population is, I wouldn't put it past.
I think a lot of people fear President Pence.
I think that's really silly.
Why?
Because if you think about the conversation we've been having, and we're all clearly with a certain bent, right? There's clearly no one sitting around this table right now who's like, rah-rah, Trump. So we have a certain bent to the conversation that we're having. And primarily what we're aghast about is his open, flagrant behavior outside of the standard norms of human decency, not policies necessarily.
Oh, I think a lot of us are concerned about policies.
Oh, absolutely,
as well.
As you should be, as everyone should be. I mean, that is part and parcel of American
because
politics.
Because this outside the norms of human decency is the no-tolerance policy.
Yeah, yes, and I agree with that too. But that's exactly the kind of thing it would be really difficult to imagine someone like Mike Pence enacting across the board, because you have to have some pretty ridiculous chutzpah to just say, oh, well, we're doing this now and I don't care what the consequences are. And that's what Trump has been willing to do time and time again. Mike Pence has been a career politician. Yes, if you are progressive or liberal, you do not like his views, you do not like what he stands for, you don't like anything that he wants, but he has never in his entire career been anything but a classic standard career politician.
I think Pence's base is smaller, though. I don't think he has quite the devotion across the board. I mean, as big as Trump is. And he is seen right now as the biggest sycophant in history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, do you really think he'd be tweeting about pardoning himself? Or I'm serious.
No, I agree, Michael. Yeah, yeah. I think that he, as a career politician, and as a somewhat, seems like more timid, who's not more timid than Trump, after mm-hmm. all? And so maybe I have to take back my reaction, because I just said that I could deal with Republicans whose policies I disagreed with. And maybe Pence, though I'm a little concerned about his strong religious bent, but maybe he is someone that I would have to say I would have to look at the policies and disagree with that rather than the behavior.
I think it'd be easier to defeat, I really do, than Trump.
Could it be that the major difference, we're going back into history now, historical parallels here, the major difference between the Nazi internment of the Jews and the Trump internment of the immigrants so far is that the Nazis kept better records and know where the kids were sent, but the Trump internment process doesn't know or care?
They haven't tattooed them?
I think that conversation is bandied around a lot, and I have to say that it's a fine edge. There's a popular rule on the internet called Godwin's Law. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. Godwin's Law. It's not a real law. It's something of a joke, but it's widely known in internet communities, and it just means that anyone who brings up fascism or Nazis first loses the argument by default. Right. And that is not to say that we're not seeing some all the classic signs of someone who wants to be and acts like they're part of a totalitarian regime. And I don't think there's any question that you can look at any number of actions and say, hey, these are unilateral actions that have no regard for the sanctity of human life. But I do think a better parallel is the fact that we shoved Japanese families and ripped their property away from them into Japanese internment camps. And we've done that. And we were okay with it. Like, the whole nation was like, okie dokie, well, you know, I mean, obviously there were forward-thinking people who are on the right side of history who were aghast at it about it at the time. But by and large, everyone went along with it. And so I think there's a closer parallel there. And if we hopefully were as horrified about the potential of us repeating our own dark history rather than looking at someone else's. That would be my hope, that that is what galvanizes us to not repeat that.
Is there a difference in the fact that I'm not defending the Japanese internment?
Right.
But that at that time there was an actual worldwide catastrophe going on. And here what we have is a mythical, we're being overrun by rapists and criminals and so on. It's a catastrophe we're responding to that isn't real, according
to... It's made up. Did anybody see Mike Huckabee's tweet of Nancy Pelosi's campaign?
Oh, I saw it.
For those of you listeners that don't know what I'm talking about, Mike Huckabee, former Governor Huckabee and father of Sarah Sanders Huckabee, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, put out a tweet of Nancy Pelosi's campaign organization, which was a bunch of MS-13 guys posing with their shirts off.
Flashing gang signs.
Yeah, flashing gang signs. So let's talk quickly about the jacket, Melania's jacket. I believe it said, "I really don't care."
Do you?
Do you, right. Who was that for? What was that about?
I really don't know.
I mean, that falls.
I really don't care.
I guess I agree. Like, I think that we could argue that one until we're blue in the face. And, you know, you mentioned earlier she's a model. How could she not know?
Well, she knew. She knew.
I agree with all of that. On the flip side, we can't know, and it's not policy, and it's just one of the things that we are screaming about almost daily in the news. I mean, do I want to accept it and be okay? No. Do I necessarily want to talk about it to death when there is literally a laundry list of 100 horrible things happening right now? That seems more pressing. Like, I want to chalk that one up onto tasteless or terrible or crass or anything you want. Throw it in the bin of terrible and move on to something bigger.
Distraction.
Tone deafness, distraction. It's hard to know which.
We've got about a minute and a half here. Are we going to see a blue or red wave this November? Trump was predicting the red wave, and he doesn't want the Republicans to do anything in Congress about immigration until all these Republicans get elected in November.
If it's not blue, I'm out of here.
I'll stick around, but I don't think that we know yet. The polls are not clear. I don't know if you guys follow 538 at all, but it's really not. For a while, everyone was predicting a big blue wave, and it is unclear at this point what's going to happen.
I read that somebody, with Trump's strategy of using immigration as his talking, as his main thing, that he it would be great and ironic if that backfired. I mean, they could be using the economy and the whatever, because the economy's in good shape, apparently, for many people, and including me, I suppose. Maybe they'll shoot themselves in the foot.
Eric Hoffer said it best, that hatred is the greatest unifier there is.
Do you have any friends, neighbors, relatives that are still Trump supporters that you can talk politics with?
Yes and no.
Absolutely.
Okay. You still do? You don't?
I'm in a bubble.
Okay. Michael, how does that go?
I make sure that I restrict the liberal side of myself that just wants to yell at them and try to ask some questions. It's an interesting conversation for sure, because grew up conservative, and I would still say that by the standards of many people, I'm right of center, but by the standards of people who vote for Trump, obviously not. And so, that is a separate show unto itself, I think, truly, because I could go on and on and
quickly,
on.
Quickly, Charles.
I forgot the question.
How's your interaction with people who are still Trump voters?
I don't talk to anybody anymore.
Like that, Judy. Like me.
Well, I don't know that I know anyone. I mean, yeah.
So the people you hang out with are of the same mindset as you regarding Trump.
Yeah, and it's not like I seek them out. It's just that that tends to be the...
We are out of time, folks. Michael, Charles, Judy, what a great conversation.
Thank you, everyone. That was fun.
And for you in the audience, thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.